And welcome back to the latest episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific, your dose of PowerPoint rehab designed to get your brain juices flowing. As always, I'm your host, Natalie Sambi, coming to you from Canberra. If you've ever wondered how some of the states other than Japan and South Korea are responding to China's rise, then you've come to the right place today. Dr. Tim Huxley, Executive Director of IISS Asia and author of Defending the Lion City, the Armed Forces of Singapore, joins me to discuss how Southeast Asia's most technologically advanced yet modestly sized militaries, Singapore, is coping with some of the strategic shifts in the Asia-Pacific, as well as the growing tensions over the South China Sea. We'll be talking about the key pillars and drivers of Singapore's foreign and defense policy, and what that means for its relationships with the US, China, its other defense partners, and the rest of Southeast Asia. But before we get stuck into that, we'll be back after this short break. Take it away, Martha.
At the bottom of every SIMSEC article, no matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And welcome back. As I mentioned, Singapore is a tiny city-state located at the end of the Malaysian Peninsula. It's roughly 5.5 million people and has grown from a small jungle island into a formidable regional hub and a tiger economy worth almost $300 billion. Also being an island state, its strategic approach has been to adopt a high-tech military and national conscription as well. But to talk to me more about these strategic developments and the importance of Singapore's view of the Asia-Pacific is Executive Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies Asia, Dr. Tim Huxley. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm pleased to talk to you, Nat.
Tim, just to introduce you to our guests, for those that don't know you, could you tell us a little bit about your background and a little bit about your work in Singapore?
Yes, I was a PhD student at the ANU in the IR department in the early 1980s, and that brought me into the field of Asia-Pacific security studies through my doctoral dissertation on the ASEAN countries' responses to the changes of regime in Indochina and subsequent perceptions of security threat from Indochina in the late 70s and early 80s. And subsequently, I've always worked, I suppose you could say, in the overlap between defense and security studies on one side and Asian area studies on the other, with a particular focus on Southeast Asia. I was an academic mainly in the UK and for a short while in Australia in the late 80s and through the 90s. And then I joined the IISS in London at the beginning of 2003 and then moved to Singapore in 2007, about 8.5 years ago. And this is the second time that I've lived and worked in Singapore. I was here in the 1980s for about 2.5 years at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies as well. So altogether, amazingly, I seem to have spent more than 11 years in Singapore, which apart from everything else, is a great base for watching the region. And it's also a very important regional for keeping a thumb on the pulse of regional political and security developments.
And obviously, being in Singapore, you've been able to observe some of the major events that have occurred this year. For our listeners, it was a state that was founded by a man called Lee Kuan Yew, who was prime minister for an extraordinary amount of time, from 1959 until 1990. And he died earlier this year in March, considered to be the father of modern Singapore. I mean, having lived in Singapore for some time, what kind of impact did Lee Kuan Yew have on the country? And, you know, who is he in terms of how he shaped the defence and foreign policy of Singapore?
Well, it's a good question. It's the right question, because Lee Kuan Yew's role was absolutely crucial in shaping almost every dimension of modern Singapore in terms of the country's domestic politics and domestic policies, including in the social arena, but also particularly in the foreign affairs and security and defence sphere. But I suppose there is one caveat I'd like to make, and that is that Singapore did have a history before Lee Kuan Yew and before 1965, and going back to the mid to late 19th century, Singapore was always the most developed part of Southeast Asia, and it was a very important colonial bastion for the British. It was the effective center of British rule throughout maritime Southeast Asia. It had a highly developed infrastructure, a very important port. It was the first city in Southeast Asia to have electric street lighting as early as the 1880s. It was always a very developed part of a very developed city in the Southeast Asian context. And of course, since the 1950s, when the PAP first came to power during the later years of British colonial rule, they have transformed Singapore. But there is a lot more to the Singapore story historically than Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP, despite their very important role. Having said that, yes, Lee Kuan Yew's rule was absolutely crucial, and particularly in terms of Singapore's foreign policy outlook and Singapore's defence posture. Within the ruling People's Action Party from the early years, I suppose you could say that there was a triumvirate of people concerned with foreign affairs, defence and security. As well as Lee Kuan Yew, there was Goh Keng Swee, who was the first defence minister from the late 1960s, and also S. Rajaratnam, who was the foreign minister for many years. And so it wasn't just Lee Kuan Yew. There was this core group of three people, supported by some very able civil servants and increasingly senior military officers who helped to develop Singapore's defence posture over the years. But Lee Kuan Yew's role was undoubtedly absolutely central, and I think it was his his outlook on the region, on Asia and on the world, which has been central in developing Singapore's foreign and security posture. So the main elements of Singapore's foreign policy outlook, I suppose, have been a very gritty type of realism, and I suppose you could sum that up as an acceptance of the world as it is, no pretensions as a very small state to be able to change the way the world works in any significant ways.
I'm just going to interject there for a second, Tim. I often quite hear the analogy with Israel's sort of geopolitical, geostrategic circumstances as analogous with Singapore's. Do you think that's an apt comparison?
Yes, I think it is apt, particularly in the defence sphere, because there are many commonalities between Singapore and Israel. They're both very small states, surrounded by much larger states. Those much larger states are also, in terms of the makeup of their population, different in ethnic and religious terms, and also to a greater or lesser degree have been hostile, of course much more hostile in Israel's case than Singapore's neighbours have been towards Singapore. But going back to the 1960s, when Singapore became independent in 1965, Singapore of course had a troubled birth. It separated from Malaysia were on terms that weren't quite acrimonious, but were almost acrimonious. And in the early months and years of Singapore's independence, there was a big question mark over whether Malaysia might try to reassert its control. In the early years, there were still Malaysian troops stationed in Singapore, and there were even fears that the Malaysians might try to mount some sort of coup in Singapore. And relations with Indonesia were very poor in the early years. When Singapore became independent in 65, Indonesia's policy of confrontasi under Sukarno was still in full swing. And Singapore, as part of the Federation of Malaysia, to which Sukarno objected, was a primary target of confrontation, which involved a low level military as well as political confrontation and interference in the affairs of Malaysia and Singapore. So there were a lot of commonalities in the early years, maybe rather less so now as Singapore's regional situation has improved and its relations with neighbours have become more equitable. But there are parallels there, and certainly Israel's strategic doctrine has had a significant role in the shaping of Singapore's own defence and security outlook. I suppose you could sum it up like this. Singapore's worst fear is that she could become the Israel of Southeast Asia, whereas Israel's most ambitious objective is to become the Singapore of the Middle East.
It's an interesting way of putting it.
So going back to Singapore's foreign policy outlook in more general terms and the role that Lee Kuan Yew has played in that, I think one key element of that has been that for Singapore's survival, it's an absolute necessity that there is a balance of major power influence in the region. In other words, that no single major power is predominant in the security affairs of Southeast Asia and the broader Asia-Pacific region. And from a very early stage, it became clear to Lee Kuan Yew and the others who were shaping Singapore's foreign policy outlook that it was a vital necessity for Singapore to keep the United States involved in regional security. And that began in as early as 1968. To 1969, when Lee Kuan Yew's government began allowing American troops serving in Vietnam to come to Singapore for rest and recreation. And then Singapore began providing commercial logistics support for American military operations in Indochina. And then during the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and more recently, Singapore has incrementally increased the strength of its security relations with the US, and that's been a continuous process. I mean, some people don't remember that and only talk about Singapore's defense and security relations with the US as being part of the rebalance. Well, those relations actually go back more than 45 years and have undergone a continuous process of strengthening and deepening.
That's very interesting, particularly for us to know. I'm interested on the other side of that, though. You talked about Singapore's general foreign policy perspective to have no major power dominant, and I assume that means also cultivating good ties with influential states in the region. And here I'm talking about China. You've given us an overview of how Singapore feels about the United States and its presence. What is Singapore's relationship with China, and how does it see China's role in the Asia Pacific?
Well, the historical background to this is quite important in that because of the colonial policies of immigration, Singapore at independence has ended up with a 75 or 80% ethnic Chinese majority in the population, and that's And that meant that when Singapore became independent in 1965, it was exceptional among Southeast Asian states in that it had a majority Chinese population. And that has had both negative and positive implications for Singapore. Negatively, in the early years, it meant that Singapore was vulnerable to political interference by China, particularly during the Cultural Revolution, in that Maoist China was able to manipulate its ethnic links with Singapore to try to foment rebellion. And in Singapore's early years, during the 1960s, the threat of communist subversion was very real. And the PAP initially came to power in the late 50s and early 60s in the midst of what you could call a struggle for power, not only the anti-colonialist struggle against the British, but the struggle within the anti-colonialist movement by those like Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP, who are anti-communists on one side, and the Chinese-supported Communist Party of Malaya on the other side. And of course, with British help, Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP were able to effectively vanquish the Communist Party of Malaya and its supporters in Singapore. But this did mean that relations between Singapore and China remained quite difficult. Although there was a low-level commercial and business relationship between Singapore and the People's Republic of China, it wasn't until 1990, after Indonesia restored full diplomatic relations with Communist China, that Singapore followed suit.
And where does Singapore find itself with China today? What kind of relationship do those two states enjoy?
The relationship since 1990 over the last 25 years has improved by leaps and bounds. From Singapore's side, the main impetus has been to try to benefit from China's rapid economic growth and growing importance in trade and investment, and by and large, Singapore has succeeded in that. And the economic relations between Singapore and China are very strong. There's been substantial immigration from China into Singapore in recent years. There are probably at least several hundred thousand recent Chinese immigrants in Singapore, many of whom have become permanent residents and even citizens of Singapore. So the people-to-people links are stronger than they have been for many decades. So on one level, the relationship with China is very close indeed. Things aren't so happy on the security side, though.
I was going to come to that, actually.
Yeah, Singapore does not have a direct stake in the South China Sea. It's not a claimant there. It's virtually impossible to conceive of the Singapore Armed Forces engaging in conflict in the South China Sea. It's very hard to envisage Singapore becoming involved in any sort of naval conflict in the South China Sea. But having said that, Singapore has been very disturbed by the rising tensions in the South China Sea, and I think has been discomforted by the extent to which China has been willing to become an assertive player in the South China Sea, and particularly to over the last year or so to build a large range of artificial structures on existing outcrops occupied by China, and to effectively militarize a large part of the South China Sea through the construction of military facilities there. So Singapore is interested in and supportive of the idea that ASEAN should assert a stronger, more common position on the South China Sea. But it's difficult for Singapore, because Singapore is only a small state with a population, as you said, of 5.5 million or so, and also, of course, it's always a complication for Singapore that she's a very different sort of state from other ASEAN members. That because of Singapore's ethnic Chinese population, Singapore doesn't like to lead from the front inside ASEAN. Doesn't like to stand out too much from the crowd. Always prefers to lead from behind. I think Singapore would prefer other larger members of ASEAN to take a leading role, particularly Indonesia. But that's not the case at the moment, and ASEAN is characterized by quite a worrying degree of disunity and a weakness on important foreign policy issues, and particularly China's role in the region. So I think there is quite a lot of discomfort and unhappiness in Singapore about the state of regional security at the moment. One aspect of Singapore's response has been to continue strengthening its defense and security relations with the US. But that's difficult for Singapore as well, because Singapore wants to keep, as far as possible, an even balance, or at least a semblance of balance in its relations with the two major powers in the region, China and the United States. So there are perhaps limits on how much further Singapore can go in developing its defense and security relations with Washington and with Pacific Command.
I mean, that was coming to my next point. There's another area of Singapore's defense relationships that I want to discuss, and that is the five power defense arrangements. And for our listeners, the five power defense arrangements, or the FPDA, is an older set but still exists today of multilateral arrangements between Commonwealth members, including Australia, Malaysia, New Zealand, Singapore, and the United Kingdom, which includes an obligation to consult even the event of external attack historically on Peninsular Malaysia or Singapore. So this arrangement endures today as a framework for defence cooperation in between those members. So if Singapore is finding itself trying to balance between relations and the US, what kind of role does the FPDA play for Singapore? And although it's got its roots back in the historical Commonwealth, does it have any utility today?
Yeah, I think the five-power defense arrangements is interesting, because I think it does play a number of useful roles. The roles are different for each of the five members of the arrangements, but I think it's valuable to each of them. And for Singapore, it's a way of making sure that the UK, Australia, and New Zealand all remain involved in regional security, so it provides an extra context for their involvement apart from the bilateral involvement. And I think it's fair to say that if it wasn't for the FPDA, the UK might not have remained involved to the extent that it is in Southeast Asian security. And of course, it's easy to say that the UK doesn't routinely make a major contribution to the five-power defense arrangements exercises and is rather an over-the-horizon participant. But on the other hand, the UK is a member of the UN P5. It's a nuclear weapons power, and I think it adds some weight to the arrangement. Australia has been, of the three external participants in the FPDA, Australia has been historically, I think, the most enthusiastic and has contributed most routinely to the exercises. And I think I think the FPDA is useful as an extra way of keeping Australia involved in Southeast Asian security, despite the vicissitudes of changes of defence minister and changes of government in Canberra, and the ebb and flow of the debate about should Australia be more interested in the wider world, or should Australia's defence interests be focused on the near region. Well, the FPDA has been there for 44 years, ensuring that Australia is routinely involved in Southeast Asian security. For Singapore, yes, it keeps the three major three external powers involved, but it's also significant in that it provides a conduit for defence and security relations with Malaysia, despite the ups and downs of the bilateral relationship. And I think it's well known that at times the relationship between Singapore and Malaysia has been testy. Sometimes it's actually become quite an unpredictable and worrying bilateral relationship. And there's been a tendency, I think, when there have been major political or economic problems in Malaysia, for Singapore to become a victim of those problems in the bilateral relationship, which has sometimes become complex and difficult. But the FPDA, again, has provided a continuing framework for defence and security dialogue and interaction with Malaysia that might not have been able to continue if the FPDA hadn't been there.
I mean, just talking about difficult bilateral relations in the region, I mean, one of the reasons for the FPDA historically, if I'm not mistaken, was actually a grouping that was, I guess, focused towards Indonesia. Now that the historical context has changed somewhat, and if we're looking for other arrangements for Southeast Asian nations to work together and potentially for Australia and Indonesia to work together, could the FPDA be one such arrangement where Indonesia could be invited, or could we even think about expanding it to include Brunei?
This has been discussed amongst the existing members over the last 20 or 25 years from time to time. The idea of the most likely development that's been talked about is expanding the FPDA into an SPDA, in other words, a six-power defence arrangements that would include Brunei. That hasn't happened because Indonesia hasn't liked the idea, and I think it was clear that including Brunei in an expanded FPDA would court Jakarta's displeasure, because Jakarta knows that the FPDA was formed in 1971 in an atmosphere when it was still thought that at some stage in the future, Indonesia under a post-Suharto regime could become difficult again and could pose a challenge to Singapore and Malaysia. And I think I wouldn't emphasize this too much, but I think in the background, that's still there. And actually, Indonesia is quite right that the FPDA could still play that role. If Indonesia did become difficult again for Singapore and Malaysia, or perhaps for Australia, in the worst case, the FPDA could still have a role as a grouping of regional states that were concerned about Indonesia.
I mean, to give some of our listeners who aren't from the region an analogy, I think of it sometimes as inviting Russia to join NATO. Is that another analogy that we can use?
Yes, I think that's quite fair. And I think it also needs to be seen in the context of the continuing difficulties in the relationship between Malaysia and Indonesia. That the confrontation officially ended in 1966, but if you look at the bilateral relationship between Malaysia and Indonesia over the succeeding years, that relationship has been quite difficult at times, and there've been territorial disputes, there've been naval standoffs. off the coast of Kalimantan. There's still an outstanding maritime dispute. It is probably fair to say that Malaysia and Indonesia still look at what the other party is doing in terms of developing its armed forces and military capability, with a view to balancing or matching that. So it is it's a complex relationship, and I'm not sure that the relations between Malaysia and Indonesia are sufficiently well developed and equitable to make it acceptable for Indonesia to join a defense grouping that also involves Malaysia.
Sure. And I want to come back to military capability in a second, but I would like to highlight in particular, not only to our Australian listeners, but to listeners from other regions, it's not just Australia that has a complicated and at times rocky relationship with Indonesia. Countries like Malaysia do too, despite being, you know, one of its closest neighbours. And we'll come back to that perhaps another day. But talking now about military capability, and in particular Singapore, we talked earlier about the analogy with Israel, like Israel also Singapore is dependent on high-tech, you know, military platforms. And I just wanted to get your sense, actually, of what characterises Singapore's investments in military platforms right now. You wrote recently about Japan's P1 leading a defence export drive in the region. What characterises Singapore's investment in military technology, and more specifically, what is pushing its embrace of UAV technology?
Okay, just to wind back a little bit on that parallel between Singapore and Israel, which is quite compelling, really, in the military sphere, and like Israel, Singapore is surrounded by bigger countries with bigger armed forces, so it can't, like Israel, it can't depend on regular armed forces. It must have conscription to provide the mass that it needs, particularly for the army. So Singapore has conscription and extensive reservist service for its conscripts when they finish their 2 years of national service, and that means that on mobilization, Singapore would be able to field an army of several divisions, which is quite remarkable for a country of 5 or 6 million people. Australia could not field an army of several divisions.
No, not quite now.
That provides several hundred thousand troops for the army on mobilization. But the other side of the picture is that because Singapore's armed forces are still going to be small compared with those of neighbours, and because Singapore, like Israel, has no strategic depth, it needs technology to mitigate those shortcomings. And that's always been the case, going back to the 1970s, that Singapore has always made an effort to invest in technology where possible, where it can afford to do so, to buy higher technology weapon systems than those which are deployed by other countries in the region, to invest in its own defense science and defense R&D establishment, and to develop defence R&D and science cooperation with as wide a range of friendly governments as possible, and to develop its own defence industry, which is able particularly to integrate defence systems from diverse sources. And so we see in recent years that Singapore has invested in very complex command and control systems, C4ISR, particular emphasis on ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and in precision strike weapons, and in weapons which weapon systems which provide Singapore with a long reach. I mean, look at the F-15 SG Striker aircraft, which Singapore's now deployed for some years, which are the most highly developed version of the F-15 strike aircraft, which would enable the Singapore Air Force to strike at very long range, and a number of other systems which are being brought into service, including larger submarines, the HIMARS multiple launch rocket system. These all provide Singapore Armed Forces with very, very heavy firepower and long range. One particular area that Singapore may need to invest more in the future is in long range maritime reconnaissance. And at the moment, Singapore depends on a small number of Fokker 50 maritime patrol aircraft, but I think it's quite conceivable that within the next few years, Singapore will want a longer range and more capable maritime patrol aircraft, perhaps the American P-8 or perhaps even the Japanese P-1, which I wrote about in a recent article.
Just returning to Singapore's aircraft for a second, obviously having very limited airspace makes training very difficult without entering into Malaysian and Indonesian airspace. So, the Singaporean Air Force comes down to Australia to do training as well. Australia and Singapore have had a very long, not just through the FPDA, but a long-standing defence relationship. And earlier this year, then Prime Minister Tony Abbott travelled to Singapore and signed a comprehensive strategic partnership with Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong. I just wanted to get your thoughts on what that comprehensive strategic partnership means and perhaps the future of the security relationship between Australia and Singapore.
Yes, Australia is a very important defence partner for Singapore. And as you say, it provides provides facilities for Singapore Air Force training, and those facilities will be available in the long term, particularly at RAAF Pearce in Western Australia, where the Singapore Air Force does its basic training for pilots. I would say though that a lot more Singapore Air Force training is done in the United States, and that for every significant type of aircraft that Singapore has in service, it has a squadron of each of those aircraft types in the US, F-15s, F-16s, Apaches, and so on. But Australia is an important defense partner, and of course there's this Shoalwater Bay training area, which is used extensively by the Singapore Armed Forces, particularly for a major combined arms exercise every year, which involves Air Force units as well as Army units. And I think there is still potential to further widen and deepen this defence relationship. And what we're likely to see in the future is probably more bilateral exercises, maybe in Singapore and the waters near Singapore, as well as in Australia and in Australian waters, and maybe also more intense defence industrial collaboration and defence R&D cooperation.
Interesting. Well, we'll definitely see where that goes. But Tim, I think we'll call it a day there. Thank you so much for adding greater depth to our understanding of Singapore's role, not only within Southeast Asia, but within the Asia Pacific, as well as the extent of its defence relationships and the importance of those relationships it has, not only with FPDA partners, but the complicated ties it has with China and the United States. And of course, listeners, you can follow more of Tim Huxley's work. You can follow him on Twitter at Dr. Tim Huxley, that's H-U-X-L-E-Y. And of course, you can follow more of our work at SimSec, our podcasts and our articles at simsec.org or at C-I-M-S-E-C on Twitter. Tim, thanks very much again for joining us.
Thanks very much, Nat. My pleasure.
And to all our listeners, thanks very much again for joining us, and we'll hope to see you next time.